Welcome to Asian Oscar Bait, a podcast that seeks to get Asians a permanent seat at the prestige picture table.
Every week, you'll hear a story about real-life Asians who we think need their own movies.
This is the 16th and final episode of Asian Oscar Bait's first season. We'll be back sometime later this year, but be sure to keep an eye out for a few one-off episodes between now and then.
And now, before we get to the storytelling, let's take a moment to reflect on Asians in the media.
The 89th Academy Awards took place this past Sunday, as did what was almost certainly the most shocking and talked about moment in Oscar's entire history. I can't imagine there's a single person listening to this podcast right now who doesn't know what I'm referring to, but just in case you don't, a backstage envelope mix-up resulted in Bonnie and Clyde co-stars Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway incorrectly reading this year's Best Picture winner as La La Land, when the winner was actually, and somehow even more amazingly, Moonlight. I am still, for lack of a better word, shook.
This topic has already been exhausted within the past week, so we won't linger on it. And besides, there is plenty of other shit for us to gripe about, which is usually the case when it comes to the ceremony. We do want to note, however, that there were actually two Asian filmmakers who nabbed prizes. Congratulations to Asghar Farhadi in the Best Foreign Language Film category, and to the documentarian Joanna Natasagara, co-director of the Best Documentary Short subject winner, The White Helmets.
Now, let's get on to some of the white nonsense that was on display during this year's Oscar telecast. Melissa, what stuck out to you?
I think the moment that most obviously stuck out to me was when they got that busload of people, like the fake tour. I mean, they clearly knew what was happening. That was like a bizarre segment.
Wait, you think the tourists actually knew where they were going?
Well, they literally walked through the doors holding their phones out.
I think that was just because they were like prepared to take.
No, they were literally
to take photos.
No, they were literally like recording when they walked into the room.
I mean,
I don't think they knew when they booked the tour, but like whatever. Hmm. I don't think they were like that surprised.
Yeah. Okay. But the thing that stuck out to me more so about that was just felt like a running gag of the night, which was a lot of jokes about people's names.
Oh yeah.
Like that. There was an Asian tourist.
So there's Asian girl. Her name was Yuri, and
yes.
Yeah, and he was like. And so the joke was, like, he didn't know how to pronounce her name. And then she was like, yeah, it's jewelry, rhymes with jewelry. And he's like, oh, okay. And then asked, like, it was her husband, that Asian guy.
They were newlyweds.
Yeah. And his name was, like, Patrick, I think. And he was like, oh, like, that's a name.
Which is racist.
Which is racist. And the other thing was calling, like, Mahershala, like, that was like a running gag. Where
he's I think he said, what do you like? Because Mahershala Ali just had a child.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, well, what do you name your kid after?
Mahershala. Yeah.
Which is actually a name from the Bible.
Yeah.
It's the longest. Mahershala is a shorter version of the longest name in the Bible.
Yeah.
It's
like a formal name. It's not like.
But it's also just, like, is there really nothing else for you to say this entire night, Jimmy Kimmel, than, like, a bunch of jokes about people's names? It was just throughout the night. Like, it just kept happening, which made it even
weirder.
Yeah, it was just gross tendency.
Yeah, for sure. And there were also, like, there were articles, I think, after that was, like, I just remember seeing this on my Twitter. People were, like, was Jimmy Kimmel, like, too political at the Oscars? I was, like, who says that? Like, did he, like, how many jokes did he even make about, like,
this? I mean, they were just, like, pretty softball jokes about Trump. I mean, I think in all honesty, I prefer someone like Jimmy Kimmel, who's, like, smirmy, like,
mm-hmm.
Wait, that's not even a word.
Smirmy.
Smirmy.
Smirking.
It's, like, smirking. Oh, smarmy.
That's
the smarmy word. Cynicism is, like, definitely preferable to Jimmy Fallon's, like, just utter idiocy. Like his good time
obnoxious
nonsensical,
yeah,
like host quality. But yeah, I mean, I don't know, I don't think anything as egregious as Chris Rock trotting out those Asian children last year occurred.
Oh yeah,
this year. But well, I mean, there was that weird thing with Sunny Pawar.
That's exactly what I was about to bring up. So in case you guys like missed this moment, Sunny Pawar, who plays the
most
little
adorable
kid,
yeah, boy in the world,
Who plays Dev Patel's younger self in
yes.
Lion.
Yeah.
So he was in the audience, and he was, like, clearly part of this, like, bit where they were asking him about, like, if he wanted more candy and stuff, which is, like, typical jokes for, like, children, I guess. I don't know. I'm not familiar with, like, the children humor world.
I think one of the questions he was almost going to ask was, what do you think about President Trump, right? Like, that, no.
Oh, my God.
What do you think about America's foreign policy, Sonny Pawar?
And he probably has something to say about that, considering his visa was denied at first.
Or Harvey Weinstein has prepped him on, like, exactly what to say.
But yeah, the joke at first was just like, oh, he's like a cute kid who just like is
who
like,
just wants
adorable,
to have candy.
Who just wants candy. Yeah, which is fine. There's nothing like weird about that. I don't know much about children. But
Melissa's never met a child.
And then Jimmy Kimmel was like, do you want to reenact the scene in The Lion King where, like, I pick you up and you're, like, Simba? Okay, he says it, like, in a much more, like, fluent way than what I just said, but still terrible.
Still, yeah. I mean, you get the gist of why that's... I mean, I hope anyone who's listening gets the gist of why that was weird. It's just... I don't, like... Is he a prop? Is he...
It was weird. And also, it was just like, oh, yeah, let's get, like, the brown kid to be,
yeah,
like,
to play,
Simba.
Yeah, to play Simba.
Yeah, it was so bizarre and so unnecessary. Like, who asked for that?
I don't know. No. Well, this is the thing. I mean, in terms of, like once again, I don't think, like, anything too appalling occurred at this year's Oscars, aside from that envelope business. But, like, maybe it would help if there were more writers of color writing that ceremony. Because I did go after it was over and look at the writing staff who was credited on IMDb, and I would say most, if not all of them, are white, which is pretty telling and not necessarily unexpected, but I think, you know, maybe if you did diversify your writer's room for ceremonies like this, then
it wouldn't be a problem.
Not run the risk of offending people.
Yeah, I can just, like, if, let's say, like, I was in that room or you were in that room, and, like, wouldn't it be so funny if we, like, lifted up this child like he was Simba in The Lion King? Like, no, that's not funny.
No,
that's
not,
like,
funny.
What is that even? Like, I don't, like, it's just, like, nonsense. It's just nonsense. And it, what? I don't even know.
I mean, speaking of white nonsense, there were a lot of Asian celebrities on the red carpet, like Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, yeah, of course. Emma Stone won.
Carly Kloss was there for some reason, like, with a 360 camera just on the red carpet, and I couldn't look at her.
I don't even know this segment.
Some sites are too raw to be forgiven.
Too raw. Yeah, but there were some, like, nice moments, though, with the actual Asian celebrities who did show up. So there were lots of really cute moments.
Yeah.
Dev Patel brought his mom, and
that
it was
really
so cute. I saw this, like, GIF set, I think, where Dev Patel is, like, they're all getting, like, their photos taken, and he's like, oh, like, mom, like, how are you? And she's like, I'm so happy. It was, like, super cute. And
really
there
cute.
Was also one really bizarre moment. I don't know if you saw this.
No.
But Jackie Chan, like, saw, like, Taraji.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
And he, like, freaked out.
No,
and,
it's because
like,
they were co-stars in The Karate Kid.
Oh, my God. That's why?
Yes.
Oh, my God. I was like, what is happening? Like, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense.
I feel like I watched that clip,
but it was adorable.
So many times because it's so adorable. But there's a moment where you are like Taraji. She's Jackie Chan when he runs over to her is holding
a panda.
And I think she sees the panda first.
Yeah.
And like just is like, oh, like a fan bringing me like
a panda,
like a stuffed animal. And then realizes it's Jackie Chan. And it's just
and
such
then she
a great,
out,
it's such a
yeah.
great moment.
Oh my God. That was so cute. And of course, Jackie Chan was recognized.
Yes.
For, you know, winning at the Oscar ceremony that took place a while ago.
I mean, I know the show was long enough, but like it always annoys me that these moments, those honorary Oscar recipients don't get to say something during the ceremony. It just feels like a missed opportunity because I think in the past few years there have been a more diverse class of honorary Oscar recipients, like Jackie Chan, also Harry Belafonte.
And we mentioned in a previous episode that like the Oscars tend to award people of color for
Spike
their
Lee.
Body of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, why wouldn't you want to hear those people speak on the ceremony? Like maybe, I don't know, maybe, you know, we could see that instead of like a busload of tourists wandering around. Wandering around like the Kodak Theater and,
oh
you know,
God.
Getting made fun of by Jimmy Kimmel. It's just like, I don't know, prioritize Academy producers.
I know. And I just can't.
Melissa is cringing. I'm just sitting here cringing.
I feel like the Oscars were just, like, the thing that is so cringeworthy about the Oscars is that every time I watch it, I'm like, wow, that was just, like, so full of missed opportunities. And that's what makes me, like, irritated.
I mean, there's always great moments. There's always, like, a few moments that really, I think, are testaments to a love of movies. I mean, I think, like, in terms of the overall production, there was, like, a good emphasis on the Academy's history with those, like, those video packages of the acting winners that played before each award was announced. But, like, yeah, I think the host is just, there's always, like, a too much emphasis on the host to, like, maintain, like, a presence throughout the night. And I think some people do better jobs of that than others. Like, Ellen is obviously great. The best Oscar host of all time is Whoopi Goldberg, who's great at that. And I wish they would bring her back. I don't know why she hasn't hosted since 2002, but...
It's probably because of her dubious rape comments.
What was her dubious rape comment?
Shouldn't she have, like, this whole thing where she...
Oh, with Bill Cosby.
Was it that?
It was Bill Cosby.
It was? Okay.
She said she wasn't... Yeah. Well, that took a turn for the depressing.
Sorry.
I think she retracted that. I don't know. I'll double check.
I think there was something else, actually, but I might be wrong. I'll have to check.
Okay. And you can check, before too, sullying, listeners.
Before sullying her name. Yeah.
Okay. But yeah. But yeah, I don't know. It's like a weird... I feel like the host just... I feel like the producers always want the host to be centralized. And it's like, that's fine for like a monologue. But, you know, put the emphasis on the people who are being recognized tonight for their achievements in the past year. Mm-hmm. And, you know... Maybe even put, like, an honorary Oscar recipient on that stage as opposed to in a box seat for 30 seconds of camera time.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I was wondering, I guess, like, before we wrap up this beginning segment, did they still do that thing this year where they got, like, student Oscar film winners to be on stage?
Yeah, those were student Oscar winners.
Yeah, I feel like they just, like, disappeared. I, like, didn't see any of, like, I feel like I didn't no, they see were them there. For some reason.
I think they were there. And I'm sure they were all, actually, I'm sure they were all freaking the fuck out.
Of course.
During Envelope Gate. Just, like.
Oh, no. But, yeah. Yeah, I just, like, I think that is, like, a great opportunity for the Oscars to, like, highlight more diverse people on stage and show how, like, they're fostering, you know, like the next generation.
Yeah, I don't think there was I don't think they, like, actually pointed them out.
I think they should. I think that would be great.
They usually do, I think, but, yeah, this year I don't think they did.
Yeah, it'd be nice to just see, like, especially, I assume that, like, they usually get a pretty diverse group of people, of students. I don't know. I just wasn't checking. Maybe they should.
Get a more inclusive
should
group.
Be. Yeah. Exactly.
As you just heard us discuss, this year's Academy Awards were, in numerous ways, a watershed moment when it came to recognizing diversity on the big screen. For all of the ceremony's inevitable and, in one occasion, jaw-dropping gaffes, there remains something undeniably moving about seeing hardworking artists, most of whom never step foot in front of the camera, receive a celebratory spotlight that is so rarely afforded them. It is perhaps fitting, then, that our inaugural season finale of Asian Oscar Bait center around a late industry craftsman whose contributions to the medium have never earned him a gold statue. In fact, there isn't even an Oscar category in which this man's behind-the-scenes achievements could be nominated, period. If you watched this year's Oscar ceremony, you might have spotted the name Tyrus Wong among the many more acclaimed and readily identifiable filmmakers featured in the In Memoriam segment. Wong passed away this past December at age 106, just days before the new year. He was not an actor, director, or producer, but an illustrator, one who resided on the farthest margins of the industry's radar for the majority of his tenure. And yet, chances are, if you have even a passing fondness for classical cinema, you've likely encountered Wong's visually poetic work within any number of iconic Hollywood pictures, both animated and live action. His legacy should serve as a reminder that the history and present of American moviemaking are brimming with artisans whose talents and efforts will never be saluted on a major stage, their faces never televised to millions around the world. But Wong's life, full of heartbreak, loss, and long-delayed acknowledgement, should serve as yet another reminder that some of the best stories in Hollywood are located just off camera, harder to find, but no less worthy of our attention. As early as he can remember, Tyrus Wang loved to draw. He was born Wang Zhenyeo in Taishan, a city in China's Guangdong province, on October 25, 1910. Seeing that his son exhibited an unusual and undeniable artistic flair, Wang's father immediately encouraged his son to follow his passion. But faced with a dwindling economy in their rural farming village, 9-year-old Wang and his father set off for America and all its purported employment prospects in 1920. They left behind Wang's sister and mother, the latter of whom Wang would never meet again. Because of the still effective Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, father and son, like many Chinese people at the time, had to take drastic action in order to reach the States. The Exclusion Act, signed into law by President Chester A. Arthur, was one of the earliest American regulations to directly and xenophobically restrict immigration into the U.S. by barring the Chinese from entering the country, with certain exceptions. Wang and his father had no other choice then but to travel to America as paper sons. They used false identities and phony documentation that claimed they were Chinese-American citizens, or in Tyrus's case, the relative of a Chinese-American citizen. At the time, Chinese-American citizens were allowed to bring over family members due to a loophole created by the mass destruction of municipal documents during the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. The disappearance of these crucial birth and immigration records gave the Chinese an unforeseen advantage. Many could now claim they were citizens, since there was no documentation to prove otherwise, and they were thus allowed to bring over their kin, or, more often, people posing as kin. U.S. immigration officials, however, were aware of the ongoing deception and insisted on keeping travel companions apart, which made it much harder for new arrivals to lie and match up stories during individual inquisitions. The elder Wang was posing as a merchant named Luk Get. Tyrus was his China-born son, Luk Taiyao. When the two disembarked at Angel Island Immigration Station, December 1920, after a month at sea, they were immediately separated. Wang's father was allowed to pass on to the mainland, but Wang himself was held in isolation for nearly a month, waiting to be questioned. "I was scared half to death. I just cried," Wang recalled of his stay at Angel Island, which was often described as the Ellis Island of the West Coast, even though it was actually open to keep the Chinese out. "Every day is just miserable." "Miserable," Wang went on. "I hated that place." Wang, whose father had drilled their fabricated backstory into him before they docked, ultimately passed his test formidably and without error. He was released from Angel Island, upon which he settled with his father in a Sacramento boarding house. But work in their community was scarce, and Wang's father decided to travel on his own to Los Angeles to find employment, leaving Tyrus behind. The reason for the separation remains unknown, but Tyrus lived on his own in the boarding house, going to elementary school and then returning to an empty home. 2 years later, the elder Wang had found steady employment in a gambling den and moved his son to L.A. In L.A., they resided in a boarding house that was overrun with vermin and located between a butcher shop and a brothel. To make ends meet, Tyrus worked after school as a houseboy for two Pasadena families who would pay him 50 cents a day. Their lifestyle was undeniably hand-to-mouth, but Tyrus's father continually encouraged his son to keep up his artistic pursuits, and even served as his first instructor. At night, the two would stay up late as father taught son calligraphy, showing him how to dip a brush in water and draw ghostly figures on the pages of old newspapers. Water and newspaper stood in for the ink and drawing paper they could not afford. In junior high, one of Wang's teachers spotted his drawings and was immediately struck by this young boy's creative capacities. A full summer scholarship to the private Otis Art Institute was then arranged for Tyrus by this teacher. By the end of that summer, Wang decided to leave junior high school altogether and became a full-time student at Otis, where he worked as a janitor to supplement his father's modest income. The institute, now known as the Otis College of Art and Design, was also located a fair distance from the family's boarding house, thus requiring him to walk many miles to and from school every day. But Tyrus, who had been an indifferent student all throughout his public school years, was thrilled to find his calling at the institute and embraced his studies with diligence and enthusiasm. He would go on to earn a full scholarship, including one in his fourth year for being the Institute's top student, an honor that deeply pleased his father. When Wong graduated from the Institute in the 1930s, after 5 years, he assumed the lifestyle of a starving artist. He scraped together money by taking on any odd job he could find. Sometimes the job would be one that directly called upon his artistry, like designing greeting cards. But most jobs, like picking asparagus and working as a janitor, only took time away from his drawing. During this period, Wong also experienced a personal setback. Not long after his graduation from Otis, his father passed away. This left Wong entirely without family for the first time in his life. But professional success was at least on the horizon. In 1934, the Art Institute of Chicago housed an exhibition of works by artists from all around the world, including Diego Rivera, Pablo Picasso, and Tyrus Wong, whose landscape print had been made using the dry point technique. He had a distinctive style, one that combined Asian and Occidental styles. During this time, Wong and his friend and Otis classmate, the celebrated Japanese-American painter Benji Okubo, were commissioned by a man named Eddie C. to paint murals for his Chinese restaurant and club, the Dragon's Den. When the murals were completed, C. asked Wong to stay on board as a waiter, an offer which Wong, still a starving artist, instantly accepted. It was there that Wong re-encountered a young lady named Ruth Kim, who worked at a nearby Chinese drugstore and ran in similar social circles as Wong. In fact, she had previously rebuffed Wong's request to buy her an ice cream. Kim joined the waitstaff of the Dragon's Den and worked alongside Wong. The two rekindled a flirtation that would lead to many dates, an eventual marriage, and 3 daughters. Not long after, Wong and his friends, including Okubo, established the Oriental Artists' Group of Los Angeles, which provided a then-unprecedented spotlight for its Asian members through museum exhibitions of their creations. In 1936, Wong joined the Works Progress Administration as an artist, creating large-scale artworks for various public spaces, like libraries. He would work for the administration for 2 years before leaving in 1938 for a steadier position at Walt Disney Studios. Fresh off the surprising success of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in 1937, Disney's animated division was gearing up to create even more animated features for a public suddenly hungry for this burgeoning cinematic art form. Wong was excited to join Disney, but soon disappointed by the assembly line position for which he had been hired. Despite his undeniable expertise as a landscape artist, Wong was set up as an in-betweener, which required him to hand-draw the thousands of sketches that smooth out the action of an animated sequence, and essentially bring these sequences to life. He was not so much creating his own work as duplicating and fine-tuning the work of others. It was a painstaking but necessary task, for which Wong was nonetheless immensely overqualified. The process was mind-numbing in its repetition, and it hurt his eyes. It was, in many ways, an insult, one probably rooted in race. After all, at that time, an Asian animator working for a major Hollywood studio was still a rarity, and Wong was not immune from the prejudice of his environment. In the company cafeteria, a co-worker called upon him, assuming without question that he worked there. Another co-worker hurled a racial slur at him. But the newly married Wong stuck it out, if only at Root's behest. And then came Bambi. At the end of the 30s, Wong learned that Disney was planning to adapt Felix Salten's 1923 Austrian novel, Bambi, A Life in the Woods, about a fawn whose mother is killed by a hunter. The adaptation made sense, but the animation was proving exceedingly difficult. In trying to replicate the Baroque and meticulous style of Snow White within Bambi's natural landscapes, Disney's animators discovered that the animals were getting lost amid all the greenery. They were deadlocked. But Wong saw an opening. He bought and read Salten's original novel and started to paint deer and landscapes using watercolors and pastels. He brought these drawings to Disney art director Tom Kodrick, who loved them and showed them to Walt Disney himself. Disney was instantly impressed by Wong's impressionistic and emotional paintings, which resembled, as art historian and animator John Kanemaker describes it, breath on the pane of a glass. In designing Bambi, Wong steered away from the realism that so many Disney animators were working hard to convey. He understood the spiritualism and mystery of Bambi's story and knew that the animation required what Canemaker calls an amorphous, delicate, and indefinite quality that everyone involved found to be incredibly effective. But he also forged a deeper connection to the tale of a child separated forever from his mother, which was, undeniably, his own story. Wong spent 2 years working on Bambi under the official title of Inspirational Sketch Artist. But he did so much more than that. As Canemaker writes, he was the designer. He was the person they went to when they had questions about the color, about how to lay something out.
Yeah.
As Canemaker writes, he was the designer. He was the person they went to when they had questions about the color, about how to lay something out. He even influenced the music and the special effects. Just by the look of the drawings, he inspired people. Finally, in a place of artistic fulfillment, Tyrus thought his future at Disney was bright. But Disney was experiencing severe financial troubles, and cuts were on the horizon. In May of 1941, Disney animators, fed up with their paltry pay and the factory-like conditions of their work, went on strike. Wong, however, chose not to. He thought Disney had been good to him. They fired him anyway, along with many of his fellow workers due to lingering post-strike resentments. And in 1942, a year after Wong was let go, Disney released Bambi, the last of the 5 Golden Age Disney classics. Wong's name was listed far down in the credits. His title? Background Artist. Wong was desolate over his dismissal, but it wasn't long before he rebounded. He joined the team at Warner Brothers, where he would remain for close to 30 years, working on storyboards, concept sketches, and set designs on films as disparate as Anti-Mame, Calamity Jane, Rebel Without a Cause, and The Wild Bunch. He took outside work in the advertising and greeting card industries, gaining a reputation for his eye-catching Christmas cards. In 1946, he designed a series of Christmas cards for Hallmark that became the season's top sellers. He was even contacted by Joan Crawford about making her a special card. Wong continued to paint and began making kites, each one designed with enormous creativity. When flown together, they resembled all sorts of shapes and configurations, like a flock of swallows or a kaleidoscope of butterflies. Wong would fly them on the beach near the Santa Monica Pier, gathering crowds and turning these kite shows into events unto themselves. Critical and, to an extent, commercial appreciation caught up with Wong, eventually. His paintings have been given various exhibitions and retrospectives, including one at the Disney Family Museum in 2003. He was at the center of an award-winning 2015 documentary entitled Tyrus from the filmmaker Pamela Tom, and he became content, even optimistic, in his later life, refusing to begrudge the slights that had been dealt to him by the film industry. Still, it's hard not to wonder what animated cinematic treasures the world might have seen had Wong been allowed the full capacity to let his imagination run free on the big screen. I find Tyrus Wong's story so interesting because it's such a rare, if all too brief, meeting of the early 20th century Chinese-American experience and Hollywood's golden era. A time full of so many fascinating, memorable figures, hardly any of whom tend to be Asian. And I think Wong's life deserves a fictional cinematic treatment, if only because there have been countless biopics about artists, whether they're painters, musicians, actors, whatever. And I would say that maybe, I don't know, 1% of these films happen to be about Asian artists.
Yeah, his story is really amazing. And I was particularly struck by the parallel, I think, between like the story of Bambi in a way and like his life that you mentioned. And I feel like that like sticks out to me as like a great example of something that would work really well in film.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see why Disney like wouldn't take the opportunity to make a film about his life. You know, that seems like the most appropriate avenue. But what do you think? Like, what kind of film are you picturing when you picture the story of his life? Because like you said, there's already a documentary.
Right. So, I mean, in terms of Hollywood history, like, Tyrus Wong was almost certainly this pioneer who deserves so much more from the industry that he gave to. But I think right now, especially, is a really opportune time for his film history. to come about. I just feel like because of the welcome success of Hidden Figures, there's this sort of renewed hunger for stories about unknown heroes, especially heroes of color.
Right.
And so, in fact, I think Hidden Figures would be like a perfect model, both tonally, I guess, for what a story about, what a film about Tyrus Wong could be, but just about the way in which it tells a story about minorities in America during the early part of the 20th century. Because I feel like part of what makes Hidden Figures so special is that its writers didn't feel the need to embellish any like despicable larger-than-life villains or these like ostentatiously racist run-ins, which, in the vein of something like The Help, in which just about like every racist character is a cartoon. But I think Hidden Figures gains this like really immense credibility for choosing to tell this story of institutional prejudice by acquainting us both with the now retrograde cultural norms of its setting and era, but by also focusing by and large on the microaggressions that its three heroines encountered on a daily basis. Like nothing, I wouldn't say that there's anything jaw-droppingly racist that happens to them in Hidden Figures. I mean, the fact that they had to endure, I mean the bathroom part is like pretty appalling. But it's not like, it doesn't, you never see their oppressors' cruelty like
wielded.
A lot wielded.
Of it's just like institutional.
Yeah, like know? I think the one of the most effective scenes in that movie is when Octavia Spencer sort of tells Kirsten Dunst.
Oh, that was so good.
It's so good. Like tells Kirsten Dunst,
I'm sure you don't think you're racist.
Yeah. Which just is so, I mean, that just says so much more about the attitudes of the time.
I think there is an opportunity, like, even, like, you know, like you said, following, like, not, like, the format-ish of Hidden Figures.
Yeah.
For more of, like, an, not an artistic, what's, like, the word? I'm like moodier, maybe, like, film. Just because it is, like, artistic. And, like, in the spirit of, like, his life and his work, I think you'd have, like, a bit more, like, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but I think you know what I mean.
No, I definitely get what you mean. And so, like, in thinking about, like, who I'd like to see handle this, at first I was thinking, like, maybe this Japanese-American writer-director, Dustin Daniel Cretton, who helmed Short Term 12. But I've sort of steered away from that idea because it occurred to me, like, actually right before we filmed this, like, what if this film was told animated? As an animated movie.
Oh, that's cute.
Like, sort of to honor, like, Tyrus's actual, you know, the actual medium in which he worked. But also because, yeah, I mean, I think it would help distinguish this movie. And we so rarely see animated movies, you know, that aren't featuring Smurfs or trolls. Like, I think animation itself is a medium that still could be used a lot more to tell, you know, adult stories or, you know, at least stories that appeal more readily to a wider ticket buying audience, but also, you know, an audience who doesn't just want to hear celebrity voices.
Oh, that's like a really cute idea, actually. I'm into that idea.
Yeah, I think I really would like to see that. But I do think, I mean, yeah, there's not, besides the animation, I don't think there's so much different from the way in which, you know, you would tell this story. Because I think whoever, like, would write this film would have to be very decisive in chronicling. And I'm decisive in choosing what he wants to chronicle of Tyrus Wong's life.
There is so much of it. Like, where are you going to start, you know?
Yeah, and also, I mean, there's an extent to which, like, it's very clear that the earlier part of his life is the most dramatic and that he's sort of, you know, the later decades of his life were a bit more comfortable and a bit more, you know, he sort of triumphed in a considerable way, not, like, a major way. But I think, you know, obviously, the stuff about the paper sons and daughters, I mean, we've rarely seen that handled in the big screen.
Right.
Much less, like, the experience of being a Chinese American in a country where, you know, you're hardly wanted. I think I would like to see a focus on the early life and then leading into the Disney years. I don't know. I mean,
or I think
there's something to be said for, like, seeing his, like, life as, like, an adult when he's, like, already trying to find work, but, like, interspersed with, like, stories from, like, his childhood. So yeah, it's kind of, like, a dual narrative.
So it'd be, like, maybe a bit more flashback reliant.
Yeah, I think that could work, but it'd be, like, a dual narrative because, like I said, it feeds directly into the work that he eventually created when he was, like, doing Bambi, you know? Mm-hmm. Disney, I'm sure, would love to make a film like this. I was thinking of, like, what's that film? The Mary Poppins, Mr. Banks something.
Saving Mr. Banks. Yes. It's okay. Kind of an awful film, but...
Oh, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, it's like acknowledging Disney's own history.
It's really important in award season, especially, to have, like, that marketing push, which is something I think we, like, didn't really talk about this season and as much. And, you know, that seems like a good opportunity.
Yeah, and there seems to be no... There would be no better testament to his legacy than to tell his story in the medium... Even, like, with the same sort of, you know, animation style that he helped pioneer. Like, if it could, you know, sort of replicate the way that Bambi looked maybe at certain parts. Or even, like, take, like, you know, be in, take on the visual language of his work.
I think this is, like, a great opportunity for sort of everyone involved in, like, the marketing side, the business side, and also just the artistic side. And I think Tyrus would have been pretty happy with that.
Yeah. Also, I just want to say that I think the father and son relationship is just, like, almost unbearably poignant.
I know.
Like, my heart, like, practically breaks thinking about seeing that depicted on a big screen. I mean, I cause when's the last time you even went to a movie and, like, saw, like, the affectionate bond between an Asian father and his son displayed on screen? Like,
even
that's never father, there.
Father-son relationships in general are...
Oh, yeah, that's incredibly, like, rare.
Yeah.
Which, like, is why I think, like, you know, obviously Moonlight is great for many reasons, but that sort of, like, father-figure relationship that Mahershala Ali plays so beautifully. In writing this story, I just... That was probably the part that moved me most. So for my Oscar clip, I wrote a monologue in which Tyrus is at home with his wife, recounting his experience of being mistaken as a cafeteria worker at Disney. Here it is. I won't ever forget the way he looked at me. I was standing by the garbage cleaning the scraps off my tray. And he came up to me. And without even a second of confusion, he asked if I could take care of this for him. I had no idea what he was talking about. But then I looked down and there was his tray. The same plate, the same scraps as mine. And that's when I looked at his face. There was no cruelty in the way he looked at me. No harm meant at all. It was the kindness that infuriated me. I wanted to wipe that kindness off his goddamn face, but I didn't. I blinked. And after a while, I said, stuttering, but, you know, clear enough for him to hear, "My name is Tyrus Wong. I work in animation." He backed away then, just dumped everything on his tray into the trash and glided away. There was embarrassment on his face, but it wasn't embarrassment for him, but for me. This afternoon, no stroke of my brush or line I drew could erase his pity. At one point, I felt my neck get so burning red that I hid away in the bathroom until I could feel it cool. And the funny thing is, I'm here telling you this now, ruining your dinner, ruining our night. But he won't ever think about that moment. Hell, the whole thing probably slipped his mind the second he left the room. But me, I won't ever forget it. I couldn't possibly. I never knew I could feel so small again.
Asian Oscar Bait is hosted by Matthew Eng and Melissa Powers, produced by Caroline Pinto, with music by Rina Minagishi and marketing by Alina Heim.
Come say hi at Asian Oscar Bait on Twitter or at www.asianoscarbait.com, where we'll be listing our sources for these histories. I want to give a special, heartfelt shout out to John Canemaker for generously taking the time to speak on the phone about Tyrus Wong and shed some light on his ever-enduring legacy. I'd also like to thank my mom, Laura Ang, for so eagerly pointing me to Tyrus's story in the first place. And finally, I encourage our listeners to check out Love Song, the latest indie drama from So Young Kim, a winning new drama about the closeness and secrecy of female friendship. It's currently playing in select theaters.
Both our moms are named Laura?
I think we knew that.